The first time I met Dr. Casey Strine was in the research seminar at Biblical Studies in University of Sheffield. The second time I met him was on a very little chair. I went to a parents' evening for new parents, for reception children, and I looked two chairs down. I said to the person next to me, "That looks an awful lot like Casey Strine." And she said to me, "That is Casey Strine." Because our children were in the same reception class in Sheffield. So it's been lovely to have a little bit of a chance to catch up with Casey, who he did his DPhil at Oxford, the best university in the world. So we're told. And Casey is now a lecturer in ancient Near Eastern history and literature at the history department of the University of Sheffield, which to you and me is, he's really an Old Testament specialist. He did his PhD, his DPhil on the book of Ezekiel, and it won the Manfred Lautenschläger Prize for Theological Promise, I think. And but the great thing is that Casey is in a top 100 university doing serious historical research and teaching and writing heavy tomes. He's also somebody who's engaged with reading the Bible with people who are seeking sanctuary in Sheffield, working with an artist, is it Emily Taylor? Yeah, on work responding to the experience of forced migration. Now, usually, biblical scholars, and he's written this book, which came out a couple of weeks ago, which is a study guide, or a study program, to do with a small group to work through the kind of issues and passages that Casey will be looking at today. These are available. Thank you very much, Cornerstone, for being here. And Casey's also recommended this book if you're interested to follow up more deeply on the kind of things he's talking about this morning. Now, usually, if you're a biblical studies scholar, people ask you the question, well, you know, can you explain the relevance of your research? I have that sometimes. Casey has a great golden card to play in response to that question, because he is dealing with one of the great issues of our time. I think that last year we were told that 63 million people were displaced in the world. That's not counting the people like Casey himself who have been displaced from America to come and live in this country, would have settled in a new country. 63 million people on the move last year. And in the light of the various dramatic events of war and natural disaster, we got to guess that that's many more now. So it's hard to have a hotter topic than forced migration through war or natural disaster or famine. And Casey is somebody who is using the insights from people's experience of that now to read the Old Testament and helping us to understand our experience now from the Old Testament as well. So there's a great link up. So contemporary, so relevant, so Old Testament. It's an unusual combination. Casey, thank you very much for coming to join us. And we do welcome you. And please come and tell us about migration, a pressing theological and ethical issue.
Thank you. Alan and I were chatting beforehand. It's certainly the first time that I can remember we didn't have a conversation where some small child kicked a football past one of us or ran into one of us or anything like that. So it was positively peaceful and tranquil compared to most of them. I want to start, first of all, by saying thank you to all involved for the invitation to be here this morning. I understand that there's also a flower show on, which means I'm certainly not the prettiest show in town, but I'm happy to be here. We're going to trust in the technology. We've laid hands on, we've prayed over, we've thoughtfully not baptized the laptop, but hopefully it's going to work and it's going to show some slides. The font is very small, but don't worry about that, because mostly I'm going to show you pictures. So there's very, very few words to read, lots of pretty pictures to look at, which I think always helps that while I'm talking. I am going to sort of follow a script this morning as I go, mostly because I'm going to try and cover a rather large amount of ground in text, and so this will keep me from wandering too far off. I know you've never had a lecturer that's wandered off topic and ended up going long and ending up in a thicket of bushes where he wasn't supposed to be, so I will follow that along. But the most important thing to say to you is I'm going to start, and I'm going to talk for a couple of minutes, and then I'm going to stop. And I haven't totally lost the plot. It's actually a designed pause where I want to give you a few moments to reflect on the issue that we're talking about. As Alan said, I've stopped even worrying about explaining to people that migration is something we need to think about and it's a relevant topic today. Pick the part of the world you want to look at. We can talk about whatever the main migration issue is there, from South America to Europe to Africa to Asia. With the exception of the Arctics, pretty much it's everywhere. And my son would then probably remind me in the Arctics we have penguins moving. So, but that's slightly different. But it is something that we're all dealing with in one way or another. And it's a very serious topic. And I want to address it with some humor, but in a serious way as well. And I make no apologies for that because I think it's something that merits that level of attention from us. So I'm going to show you a few pictures, then I'm going to give you a moment to pause and reflect on what I've said to start with and what we're looking at, and then we'll start to press on through the biblical material. So perhaps you'll remember when the so-called migration crisis, which we're dealing with now, at least as we call it here in Europe, came into our public consciousness. It was the 2nd of September 2015, so just over 2 years ago, when this image appeared on newspapers and news sites across the world. Alan Kurdi, just 3 years old, died while making the perilous maritime journey from Syria to Turkey. He was one of over 3,700 people who died on that route in 2015. More than 5,000 died on it the following year in 2016. And the numbers are a bit lower in 2017, but similarly astonishing. His image became the iconic symbol of the tragedies occurring daily on the Mediterranean. Now, juxtapose that image with this one, which resides roughly 850 miles northwest of the shore where Alan Kurdi's body was found. This stunning feat of artistic skill is Michelangelo's Pietà, which is in the Vatican in St. Peter's Basilica. It is, for many, the defining image of mourning a tragic death. Now, instead of juxtaposing the two images, I'd like you to appreciate their similarity. Now, I can't prove this view, but I remain convinced that Alan Kurdi's photo launched our ongoing dialogue about migration because it so powerfully evokes the Pietà, which imbued the image of Alan with an even deeper significance than it already held. At the epicenter of our consciousness, of our awareness, of our current debate about migration lie religion, culture, and art, even if we fail to recognize the presence. As I speak to you this morning, you're going to see a number of images. Six artists who were seeking sanctuary in the United Kingdom made them. Together with Sheffield-based artist Emily Taylor and myself, we read stories about migration in the book Genesis, and we made this art as a response. More than just aesthetically pleasing, these images hold the embodied knowledge of involuntary migration from all manner of horrifying experiences. They offer a small, perhaps cloudy window into a phenomena that permeates the Bible. I hope they'll help us to grasp the magnitude of the issue that we're exploring tonight. Two high-profile reports on migration and integration in the UK were released over the last 12 to 15 months. First was the government report commissioned Casey Review, not me Casey, Dame Louise Casey, examining the opportunities for migrants living in the UK and their integration into British society. Among its wide-ranging findings, the Casey Review concluded that high rates of transnational marriage may undermine the process of immigrants integrating into their host communities. And furthermore, the Casey Review highlighted a DeMoss study that's showing over 50% of ethnic minority students were in schools where their ethnic minority was the majority. Casey worries that this situation insulates these students from a critical opportunity to build positive links with the wider community. Such situations no doubt influence public perception, including our own. Indeed, the Casey Report noted 2015 polling data that 55% of British public agreed that there was a clash between Islam and the values of British society, and likewise that 46% of Muslims felt their lives in the United Kingdom were made more difficult by prejudice against Islam. The second report came from the All-Party Parliamentary Group on Integration. That document contends that in many parts of the UK, immigrant communities and members of the settled population are leading parallel rather than interconnected lives. Noting unprecedented levels of immigration to the UK since 2004, the report concludes that the United Kingdom has witnessed growing inequalities, rapid technological advancements, and cuts to public and voluntary sector services, which have tended to undermine opportunities for social mixing and for the integration of newcomers. These reports underscore that there is an active public debate about the integration of migrants into receiving cultures in the United Kingdom, which reflects a broader international situation. While much is being said, you only need open a newspaper, put on the evening news, or go to a news website to see that. One cannot escape the sense that the result remains a long series of ad hoc responses, very quickly formulated ideas about how do we deal with this right now for the next few months. Producing coherent views and policy positions requires a more measured approach that identifies deep convictions about how to address the issues raised by high rates of migration. And here these pressing questions can be framed even more specifically, namely, asking what would constitute a distinctly and faithfully Christian response to the current worldwide proliferation of migration. Now, Christians of all denominations recognize the importance of the Bible in shaping their understanding of and response to such issues, even if the specific role that Scripture plays in different traditions will vary. Today, I'm going to discuss a range of biblical material relating to migration from a historical perspective. And this will then provide a basis upon which to outline a Christian approach for responding to issues surrounding the integration of migrants into host societies like our own. The diverse statements in the Old and New Testaments indicate that both hosts and migrants have obligations to the other group that should promote embracing those from different backgrounds without eliminating enduring differences between them. Furthermore, the Bible outlines a view of Christian identity that supersedes national identity without eliminating its role. This relationship has consequences for Christians and countries receiving migrants, like the United Kingdom. And finally, the New Testament indicates that hosts must demonstrate self-sacrificial love that engages even with those that may pose a threat to the host, a model of self-sacrificial love embodied by Jesus himself. So today I want to try and do this by going in four steps. First, I'll outline what the Bible says about migration, attending to what I think are the most relevant statements about the duties of hosts and migrants. Second, I'll discuss what it means for a Christian to be a citizen, focusing on how the concept of Christians as dual citizens in this world impacts our role as hosts for migrants. Third, I'll synthesize this material into an approach for receiving migrants. And then fourth, I want to try and suggest at least one tangible way that we might enact that view. So, let's start a rather quick trip through the Bible. It's impossible to cover even the majority of topics one might discuss when thinking of the Bible and migration in the space I have this morning. A catalog of books in the Bible that either deal explicitly with migration or are responses to that experience includes, in the Old Testament, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, 1 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Chronicles, Ezra, Nehemiah, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, a large number of Psalms, Lamentations, Esther, and Daniel, and others I could probably add as well. And from the New Testament, one could include Matthew, Acts of the Apostles, 1 Peter, Hebrews, and Revelations, with strong cases for a number of others as well. So, I think one can justifiably describe the Bible as a collection of texts written by migrants to other migrants, often about migration. To illustrate this feature, I want to briefly review the ancestral narrative in the book of Genesis, some legal material from Exodus, Leviticus, and Deuteronomy, a key passage in Jeremiah, the portrayal of Jesus himself as a migrant, and then some New Testament passages about Christians as migrants. So, let's start with Genesis. Consider this unusual summary of the key figures in Genesis: Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. Abraham migrates to Canaan from Mesopotamia, Genesis 12:1. Immediately upon arrival, famine forces Abraham to flee to Egypt. To survive, Abraham instructs his wife Sarah to lie about their relationship. Predictably not well received by the Egyptians, the ruse still enables Abraham and Sarah to survive their time as refugees and to return to Canaan wealthier than they left. Abraham's son Isaac also faces a famine. This is in Genesis chapter 26. But rather than leave Canaan, Isaac drifts about within its borders, residing in various places to survive. Like father, like son, Isaac and his wife Rebekah employ the same tactic, hiding their marital relationship. Their hosts are not pleased with this either. But yet again, they emerge safe and wealthier than when they entered. Isaac's son Jacob grows up in Canaan, but then spends 20 years seeking asylum with his family in Mesopotamia to avoid the aggression of his brother Esau. While there, Jacob has to battle for his rights against his uncle Laban, who, despite providing him protection, holds immense power over him. Just as it is with the contemporary asylum seeker, Jacob treads carefully with Laban for fear that he might be returned to the dangerous situation he fled. Jacob finally gains independence, and when he returns to Canaan, he finds a transformed, unrecognizable society. Esau, who threatened to kill him, now wants to reconcile with Jacob. And this exemplifies just how much has changed in Jacob's 20-year absence. Jacob goes through the experience of reverse culture shock, something familiar to anyone who spent even a few months away from a place very familiar to them. And finally, there is the well-known story of Joseph. Precocious and irreverent to his brothers, as my son would say, really a bit of a brat, the youngest son of Jacob is sold into slavery in Egypt. Joseph rises from the pit to be Pharaoh's most trusted official, at which point a famine forces the remainder of his family to flee to Egypt, unwittingly allowing for their reunion. Throughout Genesis, the book as a whole, these ancestors of Israel are referred to by the Hebrew term ger, which means sojourn or resident alien, and connotes beneath that the ideas of transitory residence, difference from the host population, and limited legal protection. There are many, many ways in which these stories correspond to our contemporary society. For instance, we might categorize Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph in the terms now used by the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. And as you would expect, the UN has no shortage of jargon, but here you go. Abraham begins as a voluntary migrant, but then lives in Egypt as an environmentally induced, externally displaced person. Isaac is born to immigrant parents, and he subsequently becomes an environmentally induced, internally displaced person. Jacob is a third-generation migrant who involuntarily migrates to seek asylum before eventually repatriating by choice. Joseph is a trafficked person, placed in slave labor that reunites with his family eventually, who come to him as environmentally induced, externally displaced people. All of these figures, every one of them, is an involuntary migrant. It's no stretch, therefore, to say that the traumatic experience of involuntary migration forms a core part of these stories, and therefore the identity of those who adopt it as a sacred text. Genesis does not sugarcoat their experience either. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob fear for their lives. They behave in ways that trouble us. And sometimes they resort to questionable means to survive in their precarious circumstances. A reader justifiably wonders if they are models of courage and resilience, or if they are flawed characters who underscore our own shortcomings and moral failures. However one resolves that moral dilemma, and over the centuries and the millennia, people have resolved it in various different ways, it must not obscure that the ancestral narrative never advocates fear of outsiders. Nowhere is there a categorical resistance to engaging with those from another community. Genesis, by contrast, promotes engagement with outsiders and hospitality to others. Now, a distinct change in perspective occurs between Genesis and the legal material that follows it. Whereas Genesis stresses the experience of those migrating, the legal texts we'll look at here in a moment focus far more extensively on the experience of hosting migrants. To this end, two key terms for migrants in this material are ger, the Hebrew term we've already looked at, and nokri. Nokri is a Hebrew term that designates a foreigner, likely one who has recently arrived and not yet integrated into the community. The more frequent and the more important term is ger, again, as I said, translated usually as stranger or sojourner, which applies to a person of foreign origin who is assimilated into the host culture to at least some degree. For instance, the ger celebrates the Sabbath along with Israel. And to underscore this level of integration, recall that Abraham and Jacob are both called ger at different points. And the term even inspires the name of Moses' son, Gershom, who is born a stranger in a foreign land. Uniquely in the ancient world, the legal texts often instruct the community to treat migrants as equals. For example, Leviticus commands the people to leave part of the harvest for the poor and for the ger, for the stranger, to gather. That's Leviticus 23:22. Moreover, Leviticus states that when a stranger, a ger, resides with you in your land, you shall not wrong him. The stranger who resides with you shall be to you as one of your citizens. You shall love him as yourself, for you are strangers in the land of Egypt. It's Leviticus 19, verses 33 and 34. Exodus expresses a similar sentiment twice, with all three texts grounding this attitude in Israel's experience of living as strangers in Egypt. Perhaps it's no coincidence that the instructions predicated on the experience of Egypt appear to match the openness towards foreigners advocated in Genesis. Of course, Leviticus and Exodus cast a vision for how this looks among the powerful host community, welcoming others in, rather than in the minority immigrant group going into the host community. Despite advocating acceptance of some migrants, there are statements recommending caution towards them. Though Exodus calls for equal treatment of the ger, elsewhere it excludes foreigners from the Passover. Leviticus specifies that no animal from a foreigner can be sacrificed to God. Some texts even justify different treatment of foreigners in the repayment of debts and in the loaning of money. While these texts do allow for drawing distinctions between fellow citizen and foreigner, especially in religious practice, they do not in any way suggest the exclusion, rejection, or mistreatment of foreigners. It's possible these differing attitudes are related to discussions between groups of migrants, with the ger or the sojourner representing someone who has assimilated to the host culture more than the no-kri, therefore integrated into its practices. But these texts underscore that even in the ancient world, dealing with migrants was no simple, straightforward, open and shut issue. And yet, they never advocate closed borders, negative rhetoric, and fearful responses to migrants. There's the Leviticus text. I want to turn now to Jeremiah, where one finds a depiction of the events surrounding the final days of Jerusalem before its destruction, and then after that, the forced deportation of many of its inhabitants in 586 BCE. Jeremiah the prophet himself is not deported, but becomes what we would call an internally displaced involuntary migrant. That is, Jeremiah and his community are displaced within the borders of their country by an external force beyond their control. That results in the destruction of their city. Think of what it would have been like during the bombings in the Second World War when so many people were displaced from London. That experience differs from deportation to a foreign country, for sure. But it's hardly a continuation of life as normal. And it's hardly an experience without trauma. For comparison, think today of those Syrians still residing within the borders of their war-ravaged country, or the millions displaced within the country of Colombia. Though they've not crossed a border into another country, they most certainly are involuntary migrants, and they've most certainly been traumatized. It's hard to say in detail what life was like for those involuntary migrants from Jerusalem actually taken to the city of Babylon. There's anecdotal evidence that they had some freedom about where they settled in Babylon, a city that must have struck them as vast and strangely cosmopolitan relative to Jerusalem. The book of Jeremiah indicates these former residents of Jerusalem lived among the Babylonians, and indeed, it strongly encourages them to engage openly with their hosts. This is a passage which I'm sure you all have heard before from Jeremiah chapter 29. "Thus said the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, to the whole community which I exiled from Jerusalem to Babylon. Build houses and live in them. Plant gardens and eat their fruit. Take wives and beget sons and daughters, and take wives for your sons and give your daughters to husbands, that they may bear sons and daughters. Multiply there, do not decrease, and seek the welfare of the city to which I have exiled you. And pray to the Lord in its behalf, for in its prosperity you shall prosper." Contemporary research on migrants indicates that this sort of pragmatic, accommodating attitude is common among migrants with some choice about where they live, or those who live in close proximity with outsiders. Jeremiah implies that these deportees from Jerusalem lived in a multicultural, integrated setting that promoted an open attitude towards foreign communities. Whereas Jeremiah depicts a community of migrants with some control over where they live, the book of Ezekiel, by contrast, recalls something else entirely. Ezekiel addresses essentially the same period as Jeremiah, maybe slightly later. The destruction of Jerusalem, though, and the forced deportations in its aftermath frame everything in the book. Ezekiel, however, does not address a community living in Babylon among other groups, but one placed in a remote area, probably in something like what we would call a work camp, meant to build a canal or a dam or some sort of water-based project. Formerly the elite of Jerusalem, these men and women become manual laborers forced to work for the imperial power that destroyed their city. Ezekiel's response is to draw hard lines between its community and anyone seen as an outsider, even fellow Jerusalemites who it thinks it disagrees with its position. The strongly insular, ethnocentric response is characteristic of many contemporary involuntary migrants settled in refugee camps. Though the ancient and modern settings do have substantial differences, and we should not ignore those, the comparison intimates that using camps or other living arrangements that isolate migrant groups from the host community may work directly against the ideal of integrating groups across enduring lines of difference. Now, perhaps slightly more familiar territory, the New Testament, but perhaps in a way that you've not thought of it before. It's become common, almost even familiar now, especially at Christmas time, for people to say Jesus was a refugee. Be prepared for that to come around again when Advent gets here. This statement focuses on the depiction of the Holy Family fleeing Herod's aggression by seeking safety in Egypt. That's Matthew chapter 2. It's crucial to note that this passage in the Gospel of Matthew emphasizes that Jesus shares the experience of the whole nation of Israel from the Old Testament. The main point is that Jesus doesn't just sympathize with involuntary migrants that feature throughout the Old Testament, but in his own life experience, he can empathize with them, share something of their experience. Jesus exemplifies empathy for the displaced and the marginalized, suggesting that the Christian call to be conformed to Christ must include this feature to some degree as well. Rather, more needs to be added to this often simple rhetoric about Jesus as a refugee, I think. There are further important similarities between Jesus and another category of migrants, the Roma, or gypsies, as they're sometimes known. Defined as, quote, a member of a traditionally itinerant people living by itinerant trade, the Roma evoke much of what we know about Jesus of Nazareth. He was a man who traveled from town to town, living on the support of people who valued his teaching, even declaring, quote, that foxes have holes and the birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. It's Matthew chapter 8. It's true that the itinerant religious leader is a well-attested figure in antiquity and one who enjoyed the cultural acceptance in ancient Judaism. And yet, it's still notable that Jesus of Nazareth's lifestyle resembles the perennial movements and the cultural marginalization so common among the Roma, instead of the settled lifestyle common among those empowered to make judgments about how to treat them. Mostly the sort of people like me and you who are in this room today. Lest it slip away, then, the main point that remains is that the central figure of Christianity lived as a marginal, mobile person, mixing frequently and openly with so-called outsiders. Some of those outsiders, the Roman centurion, the tax collectors representing Rome, for instance, represented clear and present dangers to the survival of all that Jesus' own community revered. Still, no group was more hated by Jesus' community than the Samaritans. Closely related to the Jewish community that focused its religious life on Jerusalem, the Samaritans worshipped the same God, but in Samaria. To those loyal to Jerusalem, this was a heinous perversion of their beliefs and their practices. More than any other enemy, the Samaritans represented a threat residing just on the other side of a porous border, one that could be easily crossed. How did Jesus handle the situation? To begin with, he did not avoid Samaria. According to the Gospel of John, Jesus traveled through Samaria, voluntarily stopping in one of its towns to converse with a woman of ill repute and to stay for 2 days among its people. Furthermore, when Jesus had to explain the greatest commandment of Judaism, to love the Lord your God with all your heart and your neighbor as yourself, he selected a Samaritan as the paradigmatic example of faithfulness. Now, it would have been one thing for Jesus to say that you should do what the Good Samaritan is going to do. It was yet another for him to use a foreigner and a hated foreigner as the example of loving one's neighbor. The parable of the Good Samaritan is so familiar to us that the story may have lost some of its most radical features. As astonishing as it would have been to Jesus' audience that the Samaritan helped the man from Jerusalem, it would have pushed the bounds of believability to imagine the Samaritan taking the injured man to the inn where he leaves this Jerusalemite to recover. Why? Well, what would those Jews already at the inn think was the cause of this Jewish man's injuries? Bad luck? Or the hated Samaritan who brought this badly injured body through the door? The parable describes an ancient equivalent to a gang member carrying an injured member of his rival gang into a public place where his rivals congregate. Madness. The parable seeks to underscore not just that the Samaritan helps someone unlike him, not just to remind Jesus' fellow Jews that the model for their behavior is their disliked foreigner, but that this disliked foreigner goes so far as to place himself in imminent danger to ensure that the injured man finds safe haven. The parable summons us to love those people, especially those people who we think threaten our community. Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks, writing on the command to love, observes this. The Hebrew Bible contains the great command, "You shall love your neighbor as yourself," Leviticus 19:18, and this has often been taken as the basis of biblical morality. But it's not. It's only part of it. For the Jewish sages noted that on only one occasion does the Hebrew Bible command us to love our neighbor, but in 37 places it commands us to love the stranger. Jewish and Christian traditions both go to great lengths to teach the necessity of providing care to those outside the community, who in very many cases present a threat to that which one's own community holds sacred. Other passages in the New Testament reinforce this perspective by defining the Christian community as a whole in migratory terms. 1 Peter opens by referring to its audience, a collection of Christian groups throughout Asia Minor, as exiles or refugees, Greek peripedemos. This manner of address indicates that the earliest Christian communities understood themselves in this way, or at least regarded it as a reasonable metaphor for their experience. Similarly, Hebrews chapter 11 describes its paragons of faith by recalling that they, quote, confessed that they were strangers and foreigners on the earth. Now, this overview, albeit brief, shows that the Bible speaks extensively about migration. And in most cases, the texts speak from the perspective of the migrant, even characterizing Christian life by analogy to that experience. Although there are texts that address the role of host communities, what it means to be a Christian host, I think, still needs further attention. So in addition to the discussion of the biblical text on being a host, I think it's necessary to consider and take account of what the New Testament says about Christians as citizens, not just of nation states, but of the kingdom of God. Nigel Bigger provides a useful description of citizenship. He writes, quote, "It is proper for an individual to have affection for, feel loyalty to, and show gratitude toward those communities that have enabled her to flourish." One might complement that explanation with the concept of allegiance. So, for instance, in the United States, I know it sounds probably a little bit peculiar here, but this is common practice in the United States, school children regularly recite what we call the Pledge of Allegiance. And though allegiance is not a common way in which we describe the Christian faith, it is an accurate account of what it is. To confess that Jesus is Lord means to assert allegiance to Jesus as Messiah, as anointed king, who claims, therefore, dominion over all aspects of our lives. The ultimate allegiance of Christians to Jesus' kingdom moderates Christian allegiance to a nation state in important ways. Thus, Nigel Bigger goes on to argue that, quote, even where national loyalty is fitting, it should be limited, explaining that when loyalty to the nation would require harm to the community, true fidelity requires one to refuse such actions. True patriotism is not uncritical, affirms Bittiger, who also maintains that in extreme circumstances, true patriotism might even involve participation in acts of treason. Now, you should never say that in this country with an American accent, but nonetheless, there I go. Explorations of citizenship generally appeal to Philippians 3, verse 20, which identifies Christians as citizens of heaven to encourage its audience to endure faithfully in the face of persecution and trials. Now, that's not irrelevant here. But more pertinent, I think, are the analogies in 1 Peter, Hebrews 11, and the Johannine concept that followers of Jesus do not belong to the world, even though we're not to escape from it. The relationship of these various ideas to citizenship and the obligations a Christian bears as a citizen of an earthly nation state are encapsulated succinctly and powerfully in the 2nd century CE epistle to Diognetus. Bedside reading for most of you, I'm sure. Christians, it remarks, are indistinguishable from other people by nationality, language, or customs. They do not inhabit separate cities of their own, or speak a strange dialect, or follow some outlandish way of life. And yet there is something extraordinary about their lives. They live in their own countries as though they were only passing through. They play their full role as citizens, but labor under all the disabilities of aliens, strangers, foreigners, migrants. Any country can be their homeland, but for them, their homeland, wherever it may be, is a foreign country. Christians live as citizens, but as citizens who are radically committed to identifying with migrants. While followers of Jesus play their full role as citizens, they bear the responsibility to identify with and to empathize with people dealing with the challenges of not residing in their native home. In short, the very nature of Christian identity necessitates straddling lines of enduring difference and integrating into an unfamiliar and essentially temporary home. The New Testament outlines a way of living as a citizen that demands identifying with the migrant. This creates tension, no doubt, but it also enables the Christian to inhabit a unique role in the process of integrating newcomers into a community. It's now, I think, possible to integrate the biblical material on hosts, migrants, and citizenship in order to outline a Christian vision for how hosts and migrants should engage with one another. That vision advocates mutually beneficial integration that does not eliminate important aspects of difference among individuals or groups based upon obligations for hosts and migrants. The legal material of the Old Testament repeatedly commands the people of God to live as a host society that loves the stranger. We've seen that. It's familiar to us all. Though not all migrants receive the same treatment, the texts are clear that hosts should always assume a posture of welcome. Crucially, the Old Testament instructs the community to adopt behaviors that provide a safety net of material care for the immigrant should they not be able to provide for themselves. For example, look at Leviticus 23, verse 22, and the idea of leaving things in the field for them to harvest. That duty not only repeats in the New Testament, but the parable of the Good Samaritan expands it to encompass caring for even a despised outsider, when doing so may endanger one's own well-being. Hosts, and a Christian understanding of the concept, should not expect immigrants to give up or compromise their identity, but seek to love and serve them across enduring lines of difference that indeed may cause suspicion and fear. These radical obligations, and I do not by any means want to ignore that they are radical. These radical obligations for hosts do not stand alone, but rather in mutual reinforcement with the duty of migrants to seek the welfare of their host community. This concept is most clearly enunciated in Jeremiah 29, the letter to the exiles in Babylon. Recall this passage directs those people forcibly deported from Jerusalem and settled in Babylon to settle in their new environment, to seek the welfare, shalom, the peace of that city, and to pray for its flourishing. Shalom or welfare does not simply include economic prosperity or the absence of violence. It envisions a comprehensive flourishing. Cornelius Plantinga encapsulates this complex notion well in his statement that shalom is, quote, the webbing together of God, humans, and all creation in justice, fulfillment, and delight. The webbing together of God, humans, and all creation in justice, fulfillment, and delight. Migrants, wherever they find themselves, and for whatever reason, within or beyond their control, are called by God to behave in a way that promotes cohesion, personal and communal well-being, and contributes to an environment in which all people can experience joy. When Jeremiah 29 suggests this form of engagement by migrants with foreign populations, it does not, however, advocate giving up one's identity. Indeed, the passage subsequently envisions a time when this migrant community will return to its ancestral land. Migrants are called to seek the welfare of the communities in which they live without abandoning their customs or other enduring lines of difference, so long as these things do not preclude love for others as fellow humans made in the image of God, the obligation that Christians believe applies in all times and all places and supersedes all others. Migrants instead should embrace a new culture and a new set of neighbors across difference. Or as expressed in John chapter 17, migrants are not required to abandon their identity to become undifferentiated members of the society in which they live, but are called to live in a way that does not seek to avoid interaction with that society. So, as I draw this to a close, what I've sought to do this morning is to argue that the biblical material concerning migration in the Old and New Testament supports a Christian view of citizenship, migration, and integration that's not primarily interested in the rights of any party or in determining what any group might be entitled to receive. I think this is an important point and one that I want to pause on for a moment, because we are so familiar in hearing the conversation of human rights, the rhetoric of human rights and the legal issues when it comes to migration, to immigrants, to host societies. What does the United Kingdom require to do? What is the EU policy on X, Y, and Z? What does the Dublin Agreement say? How is this going to be handled by the UN with a conversation of human rights? I think that's all helpful. It's good. It is the legal structure in which we have this debate and in which we live today. But as Christians, I think we need to see that our own sacred texts, that our own approach to ethics and morality, and our own approach to policy might not be fully encapsulated in the conversation of rights. It might not be fully encapsulated in the legal framework that we have for this discussion. It doesn't mean we ignore it. That doesn't mean that it's somehow unuseful. It doesn't mean that it's somehow corrupt and unworkable. But it means that we should not allow our discussion to be defined by, and we should not let our perspective to the issue to be contained within government policy, or the legal prescriptions, or even the very positive and well-meaning rhetoric of rights. Rather, the guiding principle for the Christian, supported by the range of material from both the Old and the New Testaments, involves obligations God places upon hosts and migrants. Obligations that God places upon hosts and migrants that define the way in which we are open to and treat others. Old and New Testament texts instruct hosts to empathize with the migrant and to self-sacrificially serve them. Migrants, for their part, should behave in a way that promotes cohesion with the host and the well-being of all. Integration that results in the flourishing of all requires hosts and migrants to embrace one another across their differences in this sort of mutually beneficial way. How then should Christians residing in host communities, the situation for almost all of us here this morning in Harrogate, respond to the present increase in migration and its accompanying challenges to successfully see the integration of new arrivals? What, in other words, would one do if they accepted my interpretation of the biblical material on migration, citizenship, and integration? Now, it's impossible to answer that question comprehensively, so I want to offer one simple action to be implemented in what might be seen as a series of concentric circles, moving from the immediate local context to successively, larger national and international settings. The central circle comprises the local church, where Jesus instructs Christians to incarnate the vision of a properly functioning community for the rest of the community to see. A church might proactively build community across the enduring lines of difference that exist among Christian hosts and migrants by creating opportunities to eat together. Both the liturgical Eucharistic meal, but also informal, non-liturgical meals. Eating with Christian migrants that live in Harrogate, in Sheffield, in my case, in Leeds, wherever it may be, invoking shared faith and employing the Lord's Supper as a foundation, this strategy offers an opportunity for all involved to work out the challenges of embracing another across an enduring line of difference in a context where we should hope, I think, as Christians, or we should trust, indeed, I think, as Christians, that grace, mercy, and patience should be readily in supply. This strategy is hardly innovative, by the way. St. Paul's letter to the church in Galatia calls for this very practice. It's Galatians 2. Expanding outward, these mutually caring Christian communities might look for ways to engage a wider non-Christian community of migrants in a form of self-sacrificial love. Perhaps this takes the form of another meal, maybe in the form of a food bank that provides for people seeking asylum who are not able to work, a contemporary form, in that sense, of the command from Leviticus 23 to provide food for the stranger. Each local community will need to identify the most relevant and helpful way that it can begin to fill its obligation as a host, irrespective of whether the migrant community understands or commits to seeking the welfare of their hosts in return. This final matter is of crucial importance. The obligation of hosts to care for migrants exists regardless of whether the migrant community recognizes their corresponding responsibility to seek the welfare of the host. Responding in this way is to meet the demand clearly articulated in the parable of the Good Samaritan. Radical, high bar, but clearly taught. At the national and international level, Christians should approach these undeniably complex and challenging issues surrounding migration and integration with a particularly Christian vision of citizenship in mind. Recalling that Christians should play their full role as citizens, but labor under all the disabilities of aliens or strangers, followers of Jesus bear a responsibility to engage with policymakers and non-governmental organizations in a way that demonstrates their effort to identify and empathize with migrants. policy proposals, responses by national governments, the activities of international political bodies, and the work of non-governmental groups should all be evaluated against the twin obligations of both the host to employ their resources to care for the stranger and also to speak on their behalf, especially when the stranger, the marginalized person, has a limited ability to do so themselves. Christians can and should evaluate whether or not the financial, political, cultural, and relational capital deployed by their national government and other institutions, like our churches perhaps, have a stake that aligns with these commitments. By all means, Christians should support policies and initiatives that encourage migrants to contribute to the cohesion of their communities, of our communities, and to create an environment that is ever more conducive to the flourishing of all residents. Precisely what form such initiatives and programs might take is admittedly hard to know and different in Harrogate than it is from Leeds, than it is from Sheffield, than it is from Bradford, than it is from any other place we might name. A robust, thoughtful, and faithful response to these issues surrounding migration, citizenship, and integration will be no less complex than those issues themselves. This exploration reflects that reality, I think. I hope you do as well. My approach, no doubt, has shortcomings. Perhaps you'll point many of them out to me here in a few minutes after we've had some coffee. But its details, I hope, chart a way forward. Be that as it may, it foregrounds guiding principles that can and I think should shape the attitudes of and the responses by all people on all sides of this issue, certainly if they identify as Christian. The hope remains that engaging with the difficult questions about integration in this way will better equip Christians to serve others and to live as citizens of their respective countries so that people might marvel, and yet there is something extraordinary about their lives. Thank you.